friends. Welcome back to Mention and Dispatches as Season 5 rumbles on. Tonight, we are talking the World War II Pacific Theater of Operations, not the specific theater, the Pacific Theater, which wasn't very Pacific while it was all going on. Joining us tonight, BB Mike. Mike, how are you tonight?
I am good this evening. I'm glad to be back on Mention and Dispatches. It's been a while.
Yeah, the first appearance of Season 5 for you. And first appearance in a while, and there was no way I was going to call Gary to join us on this, because then you guys would go off and spend $500 while we're on the podcast.
That's true.
Yeah, and also joining us, our first return engagement of Season 5 here on Mention and Dispatches, Ian is back, fronting the Rocky Mountain Navy. Ian, how you doing tonight?
I'm awesome. How are you? You guys doing fine, Navy.
Doing okay. If we're gonna talk PTO, we needed a Navy guy, so you were answering the call for us. So thank you very much. So with the World War II Pacific Theater of Operations that we're looking at, one of the things, just you know, as I was looking ahead at talking about the show tonight, one of the things that I've noticed is there seems to be a lot of the World War II games that end up being set in the Pacific Theater end up being Volume 2, Volume 3, Volume 4. They end up being expansions or sequels to stuff that was all built out of the European theater, the Squad Leader expansions, the Old School Tactical expansions, even Victory in the Pacific that used the War at Sea system. War at Sea came first, and then they went over to the Pacific. Mike, any guesses as to why? What is it that makes the Pacific Theater seem to be coming in a distant second?
So, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. One of the things, and I've noticed that as well, and it came up again recently with Last 100 Yards. And I was watching an interview with the designer, and his name is escaping me right now. But he talked about that. Someone asked him, you know, it's he's coming out. He did the Last 100 Yards, of course, but he's coming out with an Airborne expansion and then a Pacific expansion, the Solomon Islands, I believe it's called. And somebody asked him, was it always your plan to do a Pacific Theater version of Last 100 Yards? And he said, well, actually, no. The fans kind of drove me nuts and demanded one. And I got to looking, and this seems to be a fairly common thing where everyone seems to focus on the European theater, and then the fans kind of go, well, wait a minute, there's this whole Pacific theater. Why don't you address that? And I don't know why that the European theater is focused on as much as it is. To me, the Pacific theater is much more interesting. You know, it's, you have the European theater, sure, okay, another world war in Europe, so...
Yeah, stop us if you've heard this before.
It's the French and the Germans and the Russians and the British. You know, but with the Pacific Theater, you've got, it's a completely different theater. You've got capital ships, much more involved naval warfare. You've got island hopping, island jungle warfare. And you've got an enemy that I think is just completely unlike, you know, any enemy we'd ever faced, and just completely different mindset. So I don't know. I don't know why that the Pacific Theater tends to get second billing, if you will. I really don't know. there seems to be a great interest in the Pacific Theater, and it's, I think now maybe it's starting to get a little more attention.
Money, probably, more than anything else. I mean, you know, look, it's Stalingrad, Normandy, and the Bulge that sell, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, Kursk. That's what sells. So,
and I would say this also applies in the digital world. If you look at Steam and what's out there, you know, you get a lot of the first-person shooter games. Well, they're mostly European theater. It's, you know, you're hard-pressed to find a first-person shooter set in the Pacific. They are out there, don't get me wrong, but there seems to be far more European theater games.
Yeah, the first-person shooter phenomenon, I think, is a very different phenomenon and mindset, in part because I don't know that there's a ton of overlap between the kind of hex encounter, deep historical sorts of stuff that we generally talk about. I don't think there's a huge overlap between that and the first-person shooter community.
Well, no.
Yeah, I think that's a whole separate podcast discussion right there. You're probably right on the observational front of more focus on Europe than the Pacific, but I think there's probably some very different reasons for it that we're not going to have time to delve into tonight. that may be one that we table for later in the season. So, Ian, what are your thoughts? Why do you think the Pacific stuff always comes second?
I think a lot of it has the history of wargaming itself. So much of the wargaming world started with ground forces tacticals. So you have your Eastern Front signature battle, Kursk. You have your Western Front signature battle, Bulge. When you get to the Pacific, there's not so much ground. I mean, we're certainly seeing more of that, but there's not that big ground battle that people really look at as a signature. Instead, they're looking at something like a carrier battle, Battle of Midway, the battle around the Solomon Islands. And so in order to do that, you need to have a naval game that isn't just Navy ships like Jutland World War One. You need to put in aircraft, and that gets another level of complexity and another level of difficulty. So I think a lot of folks stick with the ground side. In many ways, simpler is many ways roots of the game come from, and then later on in the Pacific, you add something like the carriers and such. But it's a whole different complexion in the Pacific. It's so much more naval gaming than you get for ground games in the other theaters.
Yeah, I think the air, naval, and ground integration in the Pacific was... So, observationally, it seems as though it was more important, again, without digging too deeply into all the particulars of it. I think what you saw in Europe was you did get some naval gunfire support for the amphibious landings for the Normandies and Sicilies and Anzios of the world. You did have the strategic bombing aspect was far more important in Europe than it turned out to be in the Pacific. But close air support, I think, probably mattered a little more in the Pacific than over in the ETO, even though the Army Air Corps got to be really good with close air support during the march across France. I mean, they weren't great at the start and figured it out as they went. But I think the combination of, you know, Marines coming off the boats with the air cover overhead being provided by other boats into that ground fight, you know, that was a much tighter integration than you saw elsewhere. And you know, we say the Marines for their part of the island hopping campaign. Same thing was true with the Army coming out of Australia and working their way up through the islands they were coming through towards the Philippines. You know, same song, different uniform. But again, definitely a piece of it. One of the best comparisons I saw mentioned was, you know, in terms of the air, naval, ground integration comparison between the Atlantic and the Pacific, what was the biggest or snazziest or most prominent aircraft carrier engagement in the Atlantic? Exactly, right? You know, I'll edit in some crickets there later. You know what I mean? But that's the point. There wasn't one.
Cyrano just announced, I think it was they're going to do one of their Saturday night fights, and it's a World 2 naval battle, and it was like, oh, wait, this is going to be good, and it was like, it was in the Atlantic, and I was like,
Yeah.
I might sit this one out.
I mean, you're hunting subs, but it wasn't the same kind of capital ship engagements or the extended carrier engagements. And Ian, you wrote about some of those carrier engagements for us with you know, one of the Wing Leader articles, but also the Midway stuff that you were writing for us in terms of those carrier battles mattered. You know, it wasn't just there was some sub hunting going on, not like in the Atlantic, but those big battles mattered. And so that kind of integration was definitely something you saw a lot more in the Pacific than you ever did in the Atlantic, didn't you?
Certainly. And that again, coming back to that level of integration that is going to demand a different game. People are going to play the gun battles, the naval battles around the Solomons and such, but if they really want to get that Pacific experience, you got to mix in the aircraft. And that's just taking the game up another level. There's no really good Battle for Moscow game for the Pacific. It's going to be something that's going to have to be more complex and it's going to take you more time. If you're a miniatures guy, it's going to take ships and aircraft and terrain, everything put together. It's always asking for a lot more, but I'm going to echo what Mike said before. It's also very interesting. There's so much, so many different things going on. You have everything from Marines, island hopping, down to the South Pacific, where you had the Army and the Allied armies working together to push up the islands. Not quite the same in the island hopping. The battles on the Philippines, Leyte, was not really island hopping. That was good old-fashioned ground-to-ground combat. Maybe it's not as you know, as technology sexy as the Western Front or the Eastern Front, because you have very small Japanese tanks, Shermans and M3s. Were my gosh, that was a great tank for the U.S. military. Not the same technology, but it can be the same challenge.
And I would say there's there's one exception to the large ground battles in the Pacific Theater, and it's when you start to consider the what-ifs. And I think somebody recently released a game of this where it's the invasion of Japan, you know, and that's where you might have a major land battle, but of course it didn't actually occur, but that's the only one I can think of, so that's a good point.
Yeah, the Operation Olympic.
Yeah.
Decision, S&T, Operation Olympic and Coronet.
Okay, that's it, yeah.
Takes all the way up to, yes, the huge ground battles, and even up to nukes.
The first National Guard unit that I belonged to was 1st Battalion 149 Armor out in Monterey, California. They've since cased the colors on it based on a reorganization within the California National Guard. 149 Armor was a direct lineage descendant of Charlie Company 194th Tank Battalion that was sent to the Philippines in early 42 and was actually on Corregidor when it fell. And these guys survived the Bataan Death March, some of them. And one of our conference room at the battalion headquarters there had the guidon from Charlie Company 194th Tank Battalion that they kept hidden from the Japanese in the prison camp and brought it home with them. They kept it hidden in a pillowcase somehow. So we had the original guidon that was on Corregidor, was never turned over to the Japanese, and they brought it home with them. And I remember 97, 98, 99, whenever we would do our dining in, they would invite veterans of the unit back with us. And we had Bataan Death March survivors at the dining in with us, which was pretty damn cool. There's actually one of the National Guard series, there's this National Guard lineage series of prints that the Center for Military History does, and they're available, like you can go on a website somewhere and order them, but there's one of them of an M3 tank crashing through a Japanese barricade with an anti-tank gun in it, and that was one of the guys from the 194th from Salinas, California there. He was the dude that drove the tank through that barricade was one of the guys that would come back to the dining in, and they created, somehow they got their hands on an M3, and they created a full-size recreation of that painting down at Camp San Luis Obispo out in California at the schoolhouse there with a real M3 and a bunch of mannequins and everything else. So that was kind of cool. Like, you've got the story of it all. You've got the painting in the National Guard lineage series, and then you can go see it in, you know, like life size, which was kind of cool. That right there exhausts my real knowledge of anything in great detail in the Pacific Theater of Operations. Like, that's it. I'm done. It's all your guys' show from here. Obviously, one of the reasons for needing that air-ground-naval integration is, I mean, it's a bunch of islands, right? At some point, you run out of land to put guys on, don't you? I mean, Ian, it's all amphibious ops. It kind of has to be. Or not all, but predominantly.
Well, yes, the island-hopping campaign, so the focus that you see in the ground gaming many times is that island hopping. I mean, I remember one of my earliest war games, early 1980s, Jacinto had Beachhead, which was a very simplified island assault. You had the Marines, you had Sergeant Rock sit there, and you were coming ashore against Japanese machine gun nests and mortars. You had to try to get across the beach and get up through to grab the victory point hex. And it was always the race between the guns and the mortars on the beach, trying to sink the amphib ships before they can get ashore, and you can get enough Marines ashore to get that mass to push on through what was rated as lesser capable defender. But yeah, you start with something as that, move up. If you want to talk like integration, if you go way back also to the early 90s, Gene Billingsley, I think it was, at a GMT, did Operation Shoestring, which is an early forerunner of their Next War series, same sort of similar basic mechanics. But that was a ground game on Guadalcanal, but the hidden gem of that game to me was always the air and sea piece of it. You needed to use your air power and use your sea power to get the supplies ashore, and you're always trying to figure out, am I going to bring in more troops or am I going to bring in more supplies? You bring in more troops and more fighting, but if you don't bring in enough supplies, you can't, you know, push on. So it's that balance there. And that was always interesting because I never really saw that sort of influence in any of the European type games. So yeah, it always was that sort of mix. Again, the mix that makes it interesting is how putting it all together.
There's definitely the necessity to integrate it all in the Pacific far more than there was in Europe, where you don't need to worry about carrier aircraft. You've got whatever close air support you need right there on the ground. And yet, if you look at European theater games, you don't have a ton of games with close air support comparable to the way you might in a Pacific Theater game. You do have a ton of ETO games on the strategic bombing campaign over Germany, either attacking it or defending it, either way. Same thing with Battle of Britain. You know, that was an air-only significant... It was a significant battle that was fought air-only. And you don't really have those kinds of things in the Pacific, even when you've got major air battles. And you know, Ian, you've written about some of these. Even when you have major air battles, they are primarily between carrier aircraft. It's not a lot of land-based stuff. You had some land-based aircraft battles over the Philippines, but the preponderance of them, you know, Coral Sea and Midway and all the famous ones, that's all carrier aircraft. So, you know, based on the stuff you've read and the stuff you've seen, what, if any, role was there for any kind of strategic bombing, or is it all primarily close air support of ground troops and carrier-based air battles?
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, because, once again, I think what we've sort of stumbled into here is the myth versus the reality of what would happen. The myth is that the carriers were there and it was all carrier air. The reality was, many times, especially in like the look at the Battle of Guadalcanal, you had carriers there, but the real key was actually the Cactus Air Force, the guys that were sitting on the ground. Many of the Japanese aircraft that were fighting down there were not always coming from carriers. Many of them were coming from land-based. So there's a mythos around the whole Pacific air, is that it was all carrier aircraft. But in reality, I mean, look, Yamamoto was shot down by a P-38. That doesn't come from a carrier. So I think in some ways there's been a disservice to some of that to the folks out there, that there you can do. There is actually a lot of air-to-air non-carrier pieces out there that you could play around with and experience and see what it really gets you. I mean, even you get games like Enemy Coast Ahead, the Doolittle Raid. I mean, let's do that. The ultimate, take a land-based bomber and throw it off a carrier and see what happens.
What happens is you can't land.
That's not for... at the Black Sheep Squadron either. How many of those episodes were there?
but
no, really, I mean...
But going back to that, though...
There really was a Black Sheep Squadron, right?
Yeah, but...
They were on the carrier.
That's exactly the point. There's a lot more out there that I think that people give credit to. I mean, look at the games, the air games that are out there. They go back to Battleline, Avalon Hill, Dauntless wants to evoke the... carriers, Clash of Arms, the Wing series, J.D. Webster's Wing series, Whistling Death. All those invokes carrier pieces, but if you actually get in and go through the contents, you're going to have a lot of ground-based aircraft. And Brian, you talked about the strategic campaign. Again, I think a lot of people focus on, you know, the Memphis Belle of the European theater, and they just say, okay, well, at the end of the war in the Pacific, you had a couple of B-29s with some atomic bombs, and everything was good. Again, I think they avoid a lot of questions, and maybe some people don't really want to discuss it, but the B-29 starting with high-level raids in the against the Japanese homeland, and not doing so well against the defense, not doing very good precision, so they went to the low-level piece. It was pretty brutal. There was a lot of airplanes lost, a lot of air crews lost. There was a lot of damage done on the ground, too. I mean, the whole firebombing of Tokyo thing. Yeah. Maybe people don't want to talk about the Pacific War that much, but there is that level of, it's sort of harder to walk away from brutality of it in some ways. So let's gloss it over and let's just only focus on the good side and not look at the other sides and have to look at ourselves.
Yeah, I think even folks with just a cursory knowledge of the PTO, like this guy right here, would understand and admit that the PTO probably was a place where the U.S. was a little more brutal and a little more ruthless than they were in Europe. You know, what was it? Was it Halsey or Nimitz that had the famous quote of, when we're done, the Japanese language will only be spoken in hell?
I think that was Halsey.
Yeah, that's pretty declarative right there. You know, I mean, that's pretty emphatic. We're sending these guys on a trip south, and we don't care how bad it makes you feel.
I mean, but, you know, it's true, because, like you said, it's, you know, yeah, everybody thinks, well, we dropped two atomic bombs on Japan, and then, yeah, that was terrible. But when you read about just the firebombings, you know, to me, that's much worse than those two atomic bombs. It was just incredible what they did with you know, the firebombing. It was just, it's like you said, it kind of makes you think about, you reflect inward when you look back at that and just think, wow.
Yeah, there were some things that we did that would not make for particularly good headlines anymore.
No.
But the flip side of it is, you're fighting a war, right? I mean, yep. you generally don't fight them nicely.
Yep. That's true.
One of the things that I always found a little interesting, and so I've, one of my favorite U.S. military history books was actually a college textbook of mine, and I'd be interested to see what sort of update there might be, you know, over the past 25 years, if the author's ever gone back and revised. But there was, it's Jeffrey Parrett, P-E-R-R-E-T, I don't think it's two T's, I think it's just one, but the book is A Country Made by War. And one of the theses that he has in there is that there is a particular way at the high operational and strategic level in which the U.S. fights that was heavily informed by their experiences going all the way back to the American War of Independence, and that is this idea of mass converging columns. You've got large armies and army groups that all sort of meet at a certain point. And you look at kind of the way the Union wrapped around the Confederacy, where sort of, you know, Sherman's march across the South, but turned northward to try and meet Grant somewhere in the middle, and the converging columns that all met at Yorktown. And then in World War II, when you had the converging columns that were all meeting in the middle of Germany there, one of their arguments is that in the Pacific Theater, you actually had two different converging columns. You had the Marines island hopping their way across, generally from Hawaii towards Okinawa, but you had the army that was coming out of Australia and heading basically due north through New Guinea and the Philippines and meet us at Japan. And so this theory of converging columns, the fact that Pacific Theater was fought by two different departments in the U.S. government, because at the time the Navy Department, the War Department, weren't the Department of Defense. I mean, this is two different organizations that you almost had two separate wars being fought that just both happened to be trending in the same direction towards Japan. Ian, I think that gets back to your thing about you actually did have a bunch of land-based aircraft. Well, you did, because the Army Air Corps didn't fly off of carriers. You know, that was naval aviation. So that's where you get the Cactus Air Force floating around out there. What are your thoughts on that whole converging column idea of sort of multiple folks kind of, you know, we'll meet you at Hokkaido sort of thing?
Well, I mean, we're going back now into War Plan Orange. The whole idea of we got to push our way across the Pacific to get the bases so that we can do something, influence, blockade, or invade the homeland. The earlier versions was we have to push our way across to get the bases so we can have the big battle, the big Tsushima, the big Jutland battle. To destroy their navy so that they can not fight us. And the Japanese saying they're going to attrite us as we come across and try to destroy us. But it's exactly right. The Pacific Theater really was two battles. You had Nimitz doing the Central Pacific, very marine-heavy approach, lots of carrier pushing forward. You had the South Pacific, which was, of course, MacArthur, more army-centric. There was a big navy component there. I think Hornfisher's new book, Hornfisher's Fleet at Blood Tide talks extensively about that. You know, very good read if you want to see get some insight to how different it was the back and forth, especially to the political. I mean, if you read that, you sort of think, oh, how did we get anything done between the battle between MacArthur and Nimitz going on? Who was keeping them under control? I mean, we didn't need the Japanese. We had each other.
Yeah.
that also leads to a lot of different gaming. So that's a good part for us. I just want to swing back a moment to, as we were talking about the brutality of the pieces, I mean, I have an old U.S. Army, it was a Center for Military History collection or something, and they were talking about the psychological dilemma, psychological warfare. And just there's one stat here that always stands out to me that shows to me how different the war in the Pacific was from the war in Europe. They're talking about prisoners in August 1944, at a time when German POWs were arriving in the U.S. at a rate of 50,000 per month, they took a survey of all the Japanese POWs that the U.S. had captured between December 41 and July of 44, and they came up with 1,990.
Shit.
So it was a totally different war. Yeah. And so that also makes it, you can't just pick up your European Battle of Moscow, or your favorite Curse game, or your favorite Bulge game, and drop it into the Pacific and say, I'm just going to, you know, change the wrapper on this and go. Because it was a totally different war, which calls for a totally different game.
Yeah, exactly.
Which needs a different player, too.
Well, how much of that was they knew the Japanese weren't surrendering, you know, or the Japanese chose not to surrender, and so you didn't have a choice. It's not like you had the option to take them prisoner.
And that's exactly what the article gets to, is that there was this whole indoctrination on their side and then response on our side, and that vicious circle that just kept going and going and going. I don't see so many people do that in games. Many times in games, people that gets glossed over and ignored. I mean, if you're going to have every one of your Pacific battles has to have Pacific ground combat games, you're always going to have some sort of a bonsai charge mechanism in there. I mean, Some folks like Conflict of Heroes, Guadalcanal, actually make it a whole part of the special version of the command action points for the Japanese side. But every game's got to have that bonsai charge. I mean, even that old beachhead that I talked about, that had a bonsai charge. Operation Shoestring, bonsai charge. Every game has a bonsai charge. And that's just because I think a great part of that is that's part of the myth again. The Japanese are always going to be doing a bonsai charge. You've got to watch out for that. Whether that was really their doctrine or not, more like a last-ditch desperation measure maybe, but it's become so much part of the mythos that everyone just accepted as just part of the game.
Yeah. Yeah. Mike, thoughts?
No, I think you nailed it. I mean, that's you know, going back to what I said about the fire bombings and, of course, the atomic bombs, I think that was, you know, they weren't stopping. Like you said, Brandon, what do you do? It's war. I mean, you have to keep going until there's a surrender, right? So as terrible as it was, I mean, I think it was necessary. It was just a different enemy.
Steering away from some of the more well-known and understood things around the Pacific War and what actually happened, put on your Wargamer hat briefly here, and what happens in the Pacific Theater, or how much does the Pacific Theater play out all that differently if the U.S. focuses primarily on the Pacific Theater, given that it's the Japanese that bombed us at Pearl Harbor? They started it, we'll finish it, but we're going to let the Europeans deal with the European war. We're out for revenge. We're focusing on, let's go deal with the Japanese and the hell with the rest of it. What happens to the war in the Pacific if we turn our full force and fury in that direction and worry about Europe later? Mike, what do you think?
I don't think I've ever played a game like that. I certainly have games where maybe that's possible, you know, with like Cataclysm or something, maybe Absolute Victory. But I think if that were to happen, I think the war in the Pacific would end a lot quicker, and I think there would be big, big problems in Europe.
Yeah, well,
if we did that. So that would be a whole different game. I think it would be, I don't think it'd be a good idea.
Ian, thoughts?
I think generally, the broad contours of the war had been defined before war started with the plan. I think if I remember right, we went with Rainbow Five. But the war plan Orange, we pretty much knew what we were going to do. We pretty much knew how we were going to do it, maybe by getting some more resources. But really, I'm not even sure that even that would really change that much. The ships that were being built, most of them were started before the war. The Essex class were laid down like in 1940, and they weren't going to come online any faster, even if we went Pacific first. So maybe the end game would have come a little bit faster, but in the broad scope of things, the war probably progressed at pretty much the right pace. And then even the war planners knew they had about 4 years to do it before the American public was going to get to not accepting of a longer war. So, I mean, they had a plan from the beginning. The Japanese definitely didn't let us execute it perfectly, far from perfectly, but I don't see it changing that much. Of course, none of the plans predicted the end of the with the atomic bombs. So could have that come faster or would have been slower? Would that not have happened? Would have we seen an Olympic occur? Who knows? But broadly speaking, I don't see it being that much different.
Well, you're speaking of the Pacific Theater, but what about the European Theater? How would that have affected the European Theater?
Again, you know, we talked, there's a lot of talk about Europe first. Certainly, we threw in the bombers into Europe earlier or were you in the fort starting in 42, would we have done the 8th Air Force and done the bombing, strategic bombing campaign? Maybe the B-17 wasn't very well suited for the Pacific, so would we have focused on something else and try to bring the 29 forward a little bit? Maybe. But again, still broadly speaking, the Pacific was really your Navy, Marine theater with some Army court, and the Army more was always really the European theater. I think we were just, it was just the bad, nobody before thought we could do both sides, but at the end of the day, we could. Yeah. And I don't see it changing that much.
Okay. Now, it's not something that I'd ever really considered literally until asking the question just now. So, you know, it's...
I hadn't either really considered that. I think more of the what ifs in the Pacific revolve around, you know, what if Pearl Harbor had been successful totally for the Japanese and Midway had been successful. But as far as, you know, turning the U.S. turning its full attention to the Pacific, that's an interesting question, actually.
I think the part of the Pacific that people that we're not talking about here, but maybe the one that parts that makes the difference is really more the Indian and the Southeast Asia theater. What would have happened if the Japanese had pushed on and pushed into India and pushed through China more? What if they had changed their strategy and had focused more over there? What if the peace, the ceasefires, sort of like they had with the Soviets, fell down? What? That's really where the difference. That's where I see the big difference coming. But the U.S. versus Japan, not much different.
Yeah, I was going to get to the China-Burma-India theater next and sort of ask where some of your thoughts were on that one. You sort of jumped ahead there, which, you know, hey, look, it's a podcast, totally fine. We cover a lot of ground. So in terms of the China-Burma-India theater, that is essentially a giant ground war with a really wicked logistics problem. How different did the CBI turn out to be compared to what everybody saw and dealt with in Europe? I mean, at that point, it's mass ground combat, some close air support. The Navy is nowhere to be found. It's a treacherous logistics tale trying to get, you know, logistics shipped in from India into Burma or up over the mountains into China. You know, is this just Europe with you know, a lot of extra math? You know, Ian, what do you think?
I think it's actually a great challenge for the ground gamers, because here you have, you're trying to push up a road, trying to push down the coastline or something, and you're doing it at the end of a logistics tail, at the absolute, many times the lightest of forces and the lowest levels of logistics support, terrain that's not at all cooperative, an enemy that is not going to be just rolling over for you. They're going to make it a lot of irregular warfare and the like. It's good, interesting problems. There's a lot of interesting battles taking place in a lot of interesting terrain. But I think also it's smaller. There's certainly large battles, but even those large battles in the CBI, many of them don't come close to being something like, you know, on the plains in Europe. So you're dealing with a lot smaller forces and with a lot, you're right, the logistics. You know, some people hate the logistics games, but in order to make it really matter, or to see the difference, experience the difference, you got to play with logistics and see at the end of that shoestring where you are.
Yeah, I think we've talked about logistics before, logistics games before, and I think you couldn't do a game, you know, based located in that part of the world without having some kind of logistics system. I mean, you have to have a logistics system to replicate what's going on there.
Yeah, and there have been a lot of folks that have talked over the years about the fact that the OCS Burma game is one of the best of the OCS games. In, you know, you've got a lot of very difficult challenges tactically through the varied terrain, through the limited ability to concentrate forces, but also the logistics headache, which OCS certainly pulls to the forefront. But you've got a wide variety of ground forces available that you've got to figure out the best way to manipulate those. You know, again, once you've got a bunch of tanks on the battlefield, you can mass tanks and go make stuff happen. When you've got a lot of light forces on the battlefield, it becomes a lot tougher to mass those forces simply because the transportation becomes an issue. There's only so fast you can walk, and there's only so much mechanized transport available when you've got terrain that's not very conducive to it. And so that, yeah. that Burma theater, you know, becomes a significant challenge of terrain management. Moving up to China, you know, again, we've talked PTO primarily in the comparison of sort of U.S. versus Japan and the island hopping campaign and everything. You know, China is still the Pacific theater of operations. It's still folks fighting against Japan. Mike, what, if anything, have you ever played or seen or messed with or dealt with, you know, the Chinese versus the Japanese? Because it tends to not go well for the Chinese out there and on in the ground combat area.
I don't think I've played any more games where it's the Chinese, you know, versus the Japanese strictly. I mean, I played the what if games where China's certainly a part of, you know, which way are they going to go? I can't think of any game where it's actually the Chinese, you know, that's focused strictly on that. I'm trying to think. I do, like in Cataclysm, like that's one of the what if games, you know, it's why they call it a World War II.
Yeah.
So China's a big part of that. It's, you know, you have the diplomatic piece where the powers are trying to, you know, to use China against the Japanese. And of course, the same thing's going on in Europe with Spain. So other than that one, I really can't think of any. I'm not sure exactly, you know, how specific you're talking here as far as a war game goes.
I'm just, you know, I think you, totally general.
You're on it, Mike. That it is. It's the most of your China games are going to revolve around not necessarily a force on force type of situation, but what's the influence going to be? And you need to get into a game like Cataclysm, which does it very well,
yeah,
to see what the real difference is of having that civil war going on over there and not having that civil war going on and getting those forces allied with you. The Japanese, up through the end of the war, maintained a huge army. I mean, we were strictly looking at orders of battle. We were grossly outnumbered because they had so many forces in China. Then, of course, they couldn't bring those all back. Even when they tried with submarines, were cutting it off so that they couldn't bring it all back. But there wasn't really a lot of games up there. And I'm sure something like Hobby Japan maybe has some games, and we just don't hear about it. There's a infant Chinese war game market. I'm sure they got games. Just look at some of the movies that they're producing these days. That'll tell you that they, fought these huge battles. But we don't hear it here in the West because it just wasn't our thing.
There are so many different ways in which those ground battles can unfold, right? You've got the U.S., the Brits, the Indians and Australians fighting in Burma. Do you try to retake Singapore? Do you just leave it with the Japanese and hope for the best? You've got the Chinese certainly having their fight with the Japanese. You've always got the possibility of the Russians getting involved, which they didn't do until the very last possible minute. There's some interesting theories as to why and why not, and it's not all just that the Russians were focused on the Nazis. Stalin had that non-aggression pact with the Japanese, and there's at least some evidence out there that he, despite the U.S. asking the Russians to get involved in the war, like, we're calling them the Russians, the Soviets, if you want to be technically accurate there, but Stalin really didn't want to be seen as comparable to Hitler in sort of breaking a treaty the same way Hitler did when he invaded Poland and then further invaded Russia, as a part of all that, that Stalin really didn't. I guess he thought that was going to be what made him look like a bad guy. Who knows? I mean, not there wasn't plenty of other reasons, but do the Russians eventually, what happens if the Russians roll into China after the Japanese early? Do they not leave when asked? Sort of like what happened in most of Europe. You know, the Russians kind of rolled in and they're like, no, we're good. We'll stay. We'll hang out for a while. Does something similar to that happen again? Who knows?
Again, that goes back to a game like Cataclysm, where if I remember correctly, the Russians have maybe two or three areas, and you know, there's Mongolia and Manchuria and China that, you know, that if they want to be involved in the Pacific theater at all, they got to be really careful about what goes on in those three areas, you know, Manchuria, Mongolia, and China. It's otherwise we're not going to get a foothold over there. So as far as what ifs go, you know, it's there are games out there that kind of do show that. I think Absolute Victory is another one that kind of does that. I have yet to play it, but I know that it does do that.
Yeah, and I've always been one to certainly explore a what if. You know, I'm never going to let a good what if go to waste.
And just also speaking of what ifs, I found it that the game I was thinking of earlier, the giant land battle in Japan, it was actually it's a John Tiller game. It was Japan 45, which came out last year. That's what I was trying to think of. So it's another one of those what ifs.
Gotcha. Ian, you were about to jump in there.
I was. I was going to say, looking at the giant what ifs, I think if we're trying to explore like what could happen, you got to really back out your focus and look at something like Mark Herman's Empire of the Sun series, or Empire of the Sun now. I guess fourth edition is now going to be printed. But that whole what happens in the war and how it can go so different that way. Do you want to be a Central Pacific thrust sort of guy? Do you want to come up through the South Pacific? Do you want to focus on China? That's a game. It's not truly a what if, sort of an alternate history in many ways. But that is the game. If you're going to explore these questions, you're going to have to do it at a very high level. Yeah. You're not going to find too many tactical games out there for it. You're going to have to go to a strategic game, maybe an operational, but really a strategic game that's going to get you something like that Cataclysm or an Empire of the Sun, those sorts of games.
Yeah. So you say there's a fourth edition? Do you mean my third edition has been rendered obsolete already?
Yeah, I'd have to go look on GMT right now, but I think I just saw the P500.
Oh my goodness!
For the next one, maybe it's fourth printing.
Hmm. I guess I'll have to stick with my third edition then.
Talking some of the different PTO games, Mike, you had talked about you've already got Last 100 Yards on pre-order. You probably had it on pre-order before it was officially announced.
Probably.
Going back through some of the PTO games that you have and that you've played, do you have a favorite? Do you have a specific one that really sticks out as one that you particularly enjoyed or that was more fun or was a great experience for you?
I've got, I probably have 20-plus something Pacific games, if you can believe that. That's probably more than that. There's a lot of unplayed ones. And Empire of the Sun is an unplayed one, but I have a feeling that I'm going to love that game if I ever get it to the table. And I have another one called USN Deluxe, which it's an older game, but I found a copy of it on the cheap, so I grabbed it. But as far as ones I actually have played that I like a lot, the tactical games, Heroes of the Pacific and Conflict of Heroes Guadalcanal, and I think Heroes of Pacific is probably edges out the Conflict of Heroes a little bit in my mind. I kind of like the Heroes of Pacific game better for the tactical battles. And then the other game on a higher level, and there may be some boos and jeers here, I don't know, but Fleet Commander Nimitz, it's a solo game, and I know it gets a lot of flack for... and actually, now that I'm thinking about Fleet Commander Nimitz and more editions, there's actually a reprint of that coming out, and I think there's an AI expansion pack for that coming out. So they're probably going to address some of the things that people have problems with. But I like Fleet Commander Nimitz because it's a very high-level game, but it includes naval warfare and land battles, which is kind of, I think, unique with some of these games. You don't see that much. And I think, if I had my dream Pacific game would be to have something that had ship naval combat, something on the order of Starfleet battles with the SSDs, and at the same time, you would have land invasions. You would have tactical battles. That's my dream game. So
I'm sure Ian's about to tell you what your dream game is, but you know that there's going to be...
I hope so.
Well, you know that there's going to be a certain segment of our forum population that's going to tell you that there's no amount of tweaking to Fleet Commander Nimitz that's going to fix the fact that it's a solo game. Right? I mean, that's...
No.
For a bunch of them, that's your problem.
There is no fixing that. That's a solo game.
Yeah, there's...
But they can tell me what game was like Starfleet Battles, that as far as the naval warfare, that would be awesome, because I haven't found one. I have Iron Bottom Sound 3, which comes kind of in that direction, but it's not the same thing.
All right, Ian, help a boy out here. What's he looking for?
He's looking for a Battle Wagon, Task Force Games, which has...
But I have that. that's where Starfleet Battles came from.
It's the same thing.
So Battle Wagon, yeah, that's kind of what they base Starfleet Battles on. It's not as, I think, refined as Starfleet Battles, and that's missing the ground invasion.
It is, and so the game that's out there that sort of mixes, so at the tactical level, I guess, or tactical or lower operation level, and it's a horrible mix. I don't like it. The Command at Sea series, and if you mix their ground to combat module in there, you can do the ground games, the invasions and everything. with your ships. Such personally, I don't like it. It's too simulation, not enough game, and just too much record keeping and such. Just play Command C for the naval and air battles. Don't mix the ground side. But if you have to mix the ground, I mentioned it before. The one other game that I think actually brings it sort of all together is that Operation Shoestring from GMT Game. That goes way back. Op Shoestring, I think, by 92 was one of the GMT's earlier games. I wish they would revisit and give it a modern day makeover, because I think it's actually really is interesting, because you sit there and you lay out your map. You got all the terrain, Guadalcanal, all the classic, the rivers and everything. But at the end of the day, that whole, actually not at the end of the day, I think it's like every three turns, every third day, you have to do like an air turn and an air sea interface turn, something like that. And that really becomes important, and you get to see the dependency on the air and the dependency on the Navy. You have a little bit of, you don't have a naval battles piece. You do, there's a very high-level sort of naval battles piece where you can actually fight it out over to the side. It's definitely a side, not to get in the way of the ground game, but it does show the relationship much better than I've seen other places.
Interesting, and Brant will tell you that I'm writing down the title now and probably will run off to purchase that after this podcast.
You're actually going to wait till a podcast is over?
I might. So, and we're also getting into another area of, and this is probably another podcast. We'll have to come back for another podcast, I suppose. But another idea maybe would be to combine some of these games and create a larger game from maybe a couple of games that involve naval warfare, and then you back it up with a tactical. But that's for a different podcast.
That becomes one of those large convention event kinds of things where you've got some dudes that are playing Empire of the Sun or some very high-level, strategic-level game, and when they move the one mass land unit counter onto the one hex that is the entire island of Luzon, like at that point, we shift over to the other game over on the side table, and we actually play the sort of lower operational, high tactical level battle that fights out Luzon, and then we come back over and go, okay, so that's what happened here, instead of just rolling on a CRT for that one counter, and then we go on from there. And so maybe that's how you layer those things in. It certainly lends itself to something more mega game-ish, like the stuff that Rex does up in Canada, where if you're going to work at that strategic level, you've got multiple army and naval commanders, you've got the logistics effort, but you've also got the industrial effort back in the U.S. or up in Japan of how do we keep equipment in the field. You've got the research effort of the Manhattan Project, let's get the bomb built so that we can use it. Let's figure out a way to counter the kamikaze effort. Let's figure out a way to better detect submarines. Whatever other sub-games you have, can we break the codes that allow us to shoot down Yamamoto and build those all in as separate sub-games?
Yeah, so that would be fun, and that would be awesome, but that would take as long as the actual war to play through.
Probably.
So, and one thing just popped to mind. There is one game that I can think of that kind of just describes what I was talking about, and this is not the answer to that board game I want, but I think it's War in the Pacific Admirals Edition, and that covers the naval battles and the land battles, but not quite what I was thinking of though. But I think that probably does come the closest.
Yeah, you can talk with Kim Kidd about it in the forums. He's got all kinds of mods for that game.
I've never played it because it's one of those retirement games where you're like, man, when I retire, maybe I'll try this. But
yeah, it's definitely a high level lifestyle game. Ian, we've primarily talked board game stuff. Mike's starting to throw some digital things out there. Have you futzed with any of the digital PTO games much at all?
I'm a Luddite. I'm not too much of a digital guy. I did prefer my board games. That said, Mike was talking about his solo game for the Nimitz, Fleet Commander Nimitz. My favorite PTO game is another solo one. That's Tokyo Express, old Victory Games. You play solo against the AI, and I pulled it out this last year and went through it again. Played it. The AI that's running the Japanese side is just it's a piece of art. It really does recreate the battles for you. It really gives you the same challenges. I read it in conjunction with Hornfisher's other book, Neptune's Inferno, which was talking about the experiences of the U.S. Navy at the Guadalcanal. and how we had to learn how to fight while getting our butts kicked at first. And you played something like Tokyo Express, and you sit there kind of like, you play the first couple of games, and you're getting your butt kicked until you figure out how to deal with it and how to use your force better and try to beat that AI. But it is really a piece of art. I think another game I wish that somebody would do, Compass Games Signature Edition, to bring it back, because that's just it's really is a piece of art and really a good game that challenges and brings that whole battle alive.
Yeah, well, see, I didn't want to hear that, because that one's actually on my wish list, and now it's even more on my wish list.
One of the challenges you'll run into with Victory Point Games is figuring out the copyrights and ownership at this point.
Well, I finally found a copy of that, so maybe I'll eventually get the copy of Tokyo Express.
Maybe. You'll probably have it ordered by the time we get off this podcast, so.
I've looked before, so I don't know.
We're approaching our upper time limit on the podcast here as we start to hit about the hour mark as we are recording. Folks listening to this are going, man, we're only at 55 minutes. What that? By the time I edit out me saying, that many times, like, we're going to have a much shorter podcast. So, fortunately, we haven't had to edit out any Max Headroom technical glitches yet tonight. And now that I've said that, we're about to have 3 minutes of. Ian, parting shots on the PTO. What is it that you really enjoy about the PTO? What drives you nuts about playing games in the PTO?
I love that you can do the ground, air, navy. You have games in all those different domains that you can play. That's what I love, and that's also what I hate, because I love it that you can play all the different games. I also hate that there are so many different games, and you have to find ones that strike that balance. Am I going to be navy heavy and ground light, ground heavy, navy light? How am I going to mix it? Where does air power mix in? Am I doing it really the army side or the marine side? There's a lot of games out there, but finding the right one and finding that one that balances and scratches your itch. I mean, maybe there's not one game, Mike. Maybe it's you got to play 2 to 3 games.
Oh, yeah.
Get that itch taken care of. That's what I love, and that's what I hate.
No, I think you just nailed it. Yeah, exactly. I mean, for me, it's there's enough tactical stuff out there. I think that's pretty well covered. I love the tactical stuff. And I think that's one of the things about the Pacific Theater is that you don't have these, you know, like you said earlier, these giant armies moving around. You have the more tight-knit, you have the Marines, it's the smaller battles, you have the smaller squads, which is kind of why I'm looking forward to playing Battle Hymn, because I think you take a squad of guys into battle, but you've got that, which I love. And for me, the only thing that's frustrating is, like I said, I'm still looking for that naval game it's a good, you know, naval combat. And I have Flat Top, I have Carrier, but I'm looking for something just, you know, and all I can think of is there's a computer game, Great Naval Battles, the first edition, I think, and it actually had almost like an SSD, like, you know, it tracked damage. You'd take a hit, and you would lose a rudder, you would lose steering, whatever, and you'd have to assign damage control parties, and I don't think that's out there. I kind of would like to see a really good naval surface combat game for World War II. I don't think it's there. Somebody correct me. I mean, you mentioned Battle Wagon, but how old is that?
Have you seen the
Battle Wagon?
Have you seen Picket
Battle
Duty?
Battle Wagon's 84.
Mike, have you seen Picket Duty?
What was that? Picket Duty?
Yeah.
No.
It's a solo one. Your destroyers fending off incoming Japanese attacks on the fleet, both regular air attacks and kamikazes. Banzai Cat probably still has a copy of it in storage somewhere, but has written about it before. So that might be one worth digging up and taking a look at, because you are actually, you're managing a ship, and so you've got to deal with damage control on your ship. What got hit, where did it get hit, how did it get hit, moving stuff around from there. What is it you're dealing with? But it's a very tactical single ship level battle.
Yeah, so. See, there you go. And it seems to be there's always, it's specific to, you know, like destroyers. One I have on pre-order is PT Boats and the Solomons. And, again, I think it's like you're talking about where it's very specific, though. It's, okay, we're on PT Boats and we're going to go out on these missions. And I think what I'm looking for is more like something like Midway, but with more ships involved and maybe a little more detail. Like I said, usually when you play these games, when you play Midway, it's, you know, okay, you have a carrier, you have a battleship, and it has 8 strength points. But I would like to see something with a little bit more detail, and I don't think that game exists.
Well, I think your little bit more detail starts to become that's a management issue at that point. I mean, you've got 10 different ships out there, and you're talking about wanting to manage individual systems each on 10 different ships. You know, even if all you're doing is managing, you know, propulsion and two combat systems, you know, gunfire and torpedoes, that's now 30 different things you've got to manage for three systems each on 10 different ships. That's a lot.
Have you never played Starfleet Battles?
How about no when there's
much
a reason?
What you're doing. I mean, you've got energy allocation, and you've got all these systems you've got to manage, which is why a lot of people don't like to play Starfleet Battles, by the way. So I probably just answered my own question. It would be a lot of work, yes.
Ian, you were getting ready to jump in there, man.
Yes, first Starfleet Battles came before Battle Wagon, 79 and 84. But, I mean, the other, if you want to talk tactical naval games, you're almost moving into the miniatures world. You have the old Clash of Arms, now Admiralty Trilogy, Command at Sea series. You have Seakrieg 5 series. So you're getting into the individual ships' tactical. Both those systems have advantages. Both those systems have disadvantages. But you start moving up in the world, moving up in the complexity.
Yeah.
You can even take something, the Second World War at Sea series, Avalanche, if you get one of their tactical modules, I think, I'm not sure, Dreadnoughts. Dreadnoughts was the World War I, but they have more like advanced tacticals that take you up above. But all that said, I mean, it's a good game that just has, like, Battleship Captain, Minden Games, that does have the basic combat factors, or even a general quarters type game. That generalizes some of the factors, still are good games, and you get that flavor, the interaction of the ships and the different systems without getting, well, some people would argue that Seakrieg 5 and Command at Sea can overwhelm you, but if you were an old Starfleet Battles guy like I was, yeah, that's energy management, that's a piece of cake.
You brought up the Second World War at Sea, which I was going to throw out there and just ask. I don't have a lot of familiarity with it. I've seen the promo stuff on Avalanche's website, but again, naval warfare is not my core thing. At least one game designer who is a friend of mine has described the Avalanche naval games as naval Yahtzee. I don't know how accurate that is, but they've They've made and sold a ton of them over the years, so somebody enjoys it. But Mike, where you were talking about sort of individual ships, where the ship-to-ship combat actually matters more than something like a War at Sea, where it's just sort of get them in the same area and roll a few dice. Like, it's, you know, the turning and the relationship of the actual physical position of the ships relative to each other on the map matters some in Second World War at Sea. So, Ian, you've played them before. You've got some thoughts?
Yeah, the Second World War at Sea is a series I love to hate. They're an operational game. And quite frankly, to me, they get very boring because you get three turns a day, eight-hour turns. And you have to focus on your ships, on the missions. So certain missions, you have to pre-plot for the entire game. So before you start off, hey, this guy's got a bombardment mission. He's going to go off and, you know, here's my 90 turns of plot for him of what they're going to do. Or they're going to do this for the first 30 turns and then come back and I get to wait and then replot another set of missions. So it's very much more an operational level, not individual battles, but maybe a short campaign type of game. The original battle system or the tactical combat resolution system they have is very much a Yahtzee dice. You roll the dice. I think it's, I'm not sure if it's a roll to six to hit sort of game, or roll five sixes to hit. But it is very much, it's very simple. But when you're sitting there with a game that goes out that long and you have 90 turns, and when you get to a battle, sometimes you want that quick, easy resolution. That said, they did offer some different variants that up the tactical game into a more complex game. And then you start getting a more complex tactical game, and then you're sitting there, you know, spending time figuring out this tactical game, going, hey, I still got freaking 60 turns left in this other battle over here. They certainly have a lot of, personally, I bought a lot of the games, and I end up using a lot of the counters in my Command at Sea or Seakrieg 5 games of miniatures. It was a giant counter sheet, ship collection for me.
Yeah, that certainly sounds like, you know, almost a bit of a slog to get through. that it almost becomes an endurance test as much as anything. I may be projecting on that just based on your description. You know, again, I've always admired the level of detail with which they model and do the art for all of the different ships. But I don't know anything about the game beyond just having admired the counters from afar.
And the counters are the beautiful piece. The game, like I said, I love to hate it. I love it for all the counters. I love the thought of these huge campaigns, but when you actually get into it and you sit there and you're on turn, and you're on turn 30 and you're looking at 60 more turns to go, and you're like, but nothing's happened.
Yeah.
I literally have played entire games where, so you one side, you know, had like the bombardment mission to go off and strike the ports. The other side was supposed to intercept it. And through, you know, poor playing, poor plotting, bad weather, whatever, I mean, we've literally played an entire game. It's like, okay, well, he went off, he bombarded, I tried to intercept, I couldn't. There's a little air tussle over here. But you end up the whole thing and you get done, you're like, going like, well, okay. Hey, that was nothing. It happened. And yes, that happened in real life, too. So, you know, that doesn't make such a great game.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that being frustrating. So, all right. Mike, you get the last word tonight. Parting shots?
Parting shots. Can you be more specific?
No.
About the Pacific?
No, and why would I? I want to make your life hard.
Why would Would you? Well, I'll create a question then. So, what Pacific game do we have next to hit the table? Let's ask that. I think I told you earlier. I think in the happy hour I mentioned I have Old School Tactical Volume 3 that I'm kind of eager to get to the table. But at the same time, I still have Combat Commander Pacific, which I learned strictly for Origins. I've actually played a game of that, but I need to get it back to the table too. So I think either one of those will be my next Pacific war game that I'll get to the table. And I also say that I, you know, when you said we were going to do a Pacific Theater podcast, I wasn't sure we would have enough material to fill an hour, but we could probably have a couple more of these at some point.
Maybe. It's going to be just the two of you guys. We don't have anybody else to talk PTO on the site.
That's hard to believe. And it goes back to what we said at the beginning of this podcast. I don't get it. I don't get it.
We probably have somebody else we could draft into it. Yeah, whatever the next PTO game to hit my table is. So, again, looking at the game shelf, I have the Pacific War from Lock and Load. That might be it. I mean, that seriously might be it for PTO games for me.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just, well, keep in mind, too, that a lot of my shtick is sort of modern ground combat. That's why I've got, like, the World at War 85 stuff over there, Force Eagles War, Fireteam, Team Yankee, Battlefield Europe, Test of Arms. Like, that's the core of what I've got over there on the shelf, is all those things. So, not a ton of PTO stuff that I'm really chasing around on that front.
So, parting advice for me is don't be too eager to get the Pacific War on the table.
So
that rule book is kind of a mess.
Yeah, it was a bit of a mess. Actually, you know what, though? I do have the C3I magazine with Warplan Orange over there. So maybe that's going to be the next one to hit the table, simply because it's one of two, right? I can flip a coin and pick one.
I wouldn't even flip the coin. I would just go for Warplan Orange.
Ian, next Pacific game to hit your table?
I think probably Pacific Fury from Revolution Games. It's a campaign around Guadalcanal. It's a very different game. You have your two sides, your Japanese and the Americans, of course, but what you're doing is you're taking your ships and you're organizing them into task forces, and you organize them, have to lay out how they're going to enter the battle through the month. So are you going to try to go in and clear out Iron Bottom Sound so that your transports can get ashore? Are you going to try to sneak through the Tokyo Express to get some additional troops ashore? Because the ultimate game, when the game revolves around the victory condition, controlling Henderson Field and the Cactus Air Force, and the Japanese are trying to knock it down to keep the airfield not being operational, and the Americans are trying to keep it going. So you get a little bit of some carrier battles around, but you really comes into, especially as the game goes on, your forces are being worn down. Do I really have enough to make that push to seize Iron Bottom Sound so I can get my transports in? I remind you that this time I'm going to not get the transports through and just try to sink the other side before they get it. Every turn, only one side has the amphibious mark, because there's rules for who gets the amphibs, so you sort of know who's sort of got the offensive initiative, so to speak. A very interesting game. I wish Revolution Games put that out. Somebody here in the D.C. area redid it with blocks, blue blocks and red blocks. You don't see, it's part of the fog of war, you don't see what the other side's doing. You see some blocks coming out, you see blocks being organized, you don't know who's who until you actually engage. A very interesting game and a very interesting look at the whole battles around Guadalcanal. I want to get that one.
I actually have that game, and I think the only reason that I have not got that to table yet is because of the hidden piece is so prominent in that game that, you know, to solo it, and that would be kind of a difficult thing to do, a challenge that I'll accept because I'm pretty sure there's a way around it. And if I'm not mistaken, that's also it's from a Japanese designer. Is that not correct?
Yes, it is. It was another one of the Banzai games that Richard Revolution brought over. Translated and brought over. It's another nice small game.
Yeah,
there's one that's not super expensive, but a very interesting look at the battle, and a little bit of a different look at the battle. But nonetheless, a very challenging battle.
Yeah,
you guys live in the same metro area. I think y'all can figure this out.
Maybe one of these days, but while we're all quarantined, I'm about 3 hours south of D.C. right now. So
yeah, I get that we got to get past the plague and all that. Like, I'm not totally discounting that and all, but you know,
I mean, there could be a tabletop simulator version of this out there. I don't know. Who knows? And I know a guy that can create a version of it. If there's not,
if there isn't a even if there is a tabletop That's simulator probably. Version. You can do the Fog of War in it. So,
yeah.
Alrighty. Well, now that we've blown well past our hour mark, because our last word lasted 15 minutes, I think we're going to call it a night here. Ian, thank you very much for joining us again. We'll try not to turn you into the unofficial co-host of the show over the rest of this season, but we appreciate you coming back and joining us when you can.
I'd be more than happy, unofficial or not. Reach out, let's talk.
You betcha. And, Mike, I'm going to hang up before you decide to go start hunting sales online and spend $500.
Okay, but that's not going to stop me from looking for things online.
Well, no, but this way I have plausible deniability about not having even a party to it.
There you go. When this thing goes to trial, you don't want any part of it.
Exactly. As that lawyer said on that Reddit thread that we were talking about on the forums today, like, I'm an attorney, the secret is to shut the bleep up, right?
That's right, exactly. Yeah, I wasted 2 hours on that. Thank you, by the way.
Dude, I lost a half a day. Ian, if you don't know what we're talking about, there's a great Reddit thread that what's an industry secret in the field you work in? And one of them was, I'm an attorney, the secret is to shut the bleep up. But there's a ton of great comments. You know, I design slot machines for casinos. Don't play the slot machines. there's just a ton of great industry secrets in there. It's a riot. So thank you guys for joining us. Thank you, audience, for joining us. And we'll catch you on the next episode of Mission Ninjas, mentioned in Dispatches. I promise I haven't been drinking tonight. Not yet.
I have.
Good for you. I'm headed that way.